Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, where we go beyond the headlines with insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So, whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with the stories that really matter. And coming up in the next 30 minutes, the high-stakes implications of the budget speech postponement, the DA spokesman on finance and a leading political commentator. Also, the repercussions of the hotly contested 2 percentage point VAT increase had come into effect. I'll talk to a top economist. And why travellers are opting for shorter, more frequent and more affordable getaways. It's Thursday, the 20th of February. Now, South Africa at a standstill yesterday as the budget speech was postponed with only minutes' notice. And the markets today, though, seemingly shrugging off the drama. Both the JSE and the Rand are in positive territory. Business Unity South Africa saying the country can, and I quote, ill afford budget uncertainty. Well, someone who was at the heart of the issue is Dr. Mark Burke, DA spokesperson on finance, and joins me on the program now. Mark, a very warm welcome. Your party says a tax hike like that would have broken the economy. It's quite a statement to make. On what economic models or precedents did you base that claim?
Yes, there's of course the internal modeling. I think the overarching point here is we would have loved to see versions of modeling and be included in the process to come up with the arguments for this 2% VAT increase, which of course we would never support. But this is Treasury's job to model for us. But our internal modeling, to answer your question, indicates to us that businesses in South Africa are no longer able to absorb pain. So if there's a 2% VAT increase, they will probably pass that on to consumers. If they pass that on to consumers, you could have a commensurate inflation increase, or at least a 1.7% inflation increase. And if we have a 1.7% inflation increase, then the two rate cuts the markets were expecting over the next 6 to 12 months is highly unlikely, because the Reserve Bank can't very well be cutting rates while inflation is going up. It'll have the reverse effect. All of those things will constrain the economy. It'll further constrain the ability for South African consumers to participate in the economy and consume goods and services here. And it'll further slow us down. And if we put all of those things aside in the budget, we also need to see a budget focused on growth and infrastructure. If we invest in infrastructure now, we create short-term jobs, but more importantly, long-term, we create the environment for the private sector to create sustainable jobs. Those activities will lead to, you know, more people being employed and higher taxes.
I'm interested to know, and you're probably closer to this than most, why South Africans found out about all of this at the very last minute. It was the suddenness, I think, that took everyone by surprise. I'm sure you'll agree.
It's because the ANC loves to weaponize time.
In what way?
Well, the fact is, they could have taken the nation into their confidence. Treasury works for 2 to 3 weeks full steam to come up with these budget documents. There was a directional indication that was published in News 24 this morning that I can talk about. There was a directional indication in Cabinet that tax increases are going to be proposed. The DA made it very clear at that point and that at Cabinet meeting we wouldn't support it. There was then an engagement from our Deputy Minister of Finance and the Minister, all of this published in News 24, saying we cannot support tax increases. And then a high-level meeting of our leadership with the minister saying we cannot support these taxes, and they just arrogantly decided to plow ahead and force the hand of a sitting yesterday saying we're going to have to push this budget through. So it's exactly what they've always done, which is weaponizing time and holding South Africa hostage while doing so.
How much pressure is this putting on the GNU right now?
I maintain, and the DA maintains, that the GNU remains solid. I've always said that disagreements will arise, but those disagreements should not be construed as the end of the government of national unity. The DA remains committed to it. But for the GNU to function as envisaged, the ANC needs to realize that they control 39% of the seats in parliament, and they need to act accordingly. They cannot steamroll a dated National Democratic Revolution and impose an ANC 2% VAT increase. It's simply unacceptable.
Is your party confident that ahead of March 12, when the revised budget will be delivered, some kind of compromise will be reached to the satisfaction of all of those sitting within the coalition government? And what is happening right now in that respect?
Well, the ANC must get the house in order. Just in yesterday's cabinet meeting, they weren't singing from the same hymn sheet between the ministers there. And if they are able to get the house in order, then they must come up with a proposal that does not include these tax increases and is growth-focused and is job creation-friendly. And if those things happen, then yes, absolutely, by the 12th of March, well, we should be in a position to come up with a better budget than whatever nonsense was proposed to us yesterday.
But this has done investor confidence no good.
I disagree with that point, Jeremy. As a rational investor, I would look at the situation and say, yes, in the past, and there's a philosophical point here. In the past, we've looked at South Africa for the last 10 years at least, if not the last 20, and said, we know it's bad, but we can at least quantify how bad it is. And it doesn't have to be that way. I think a rational investor should look, and the markets, by the way, are saying this, the rand hasn't deteriorated rapidly since yesterday. There's been at most a 1% decrease. But a rational investor should be looking at South Africa and saying, oh, wait, there's now a counterparty that won't rubber stamp bad policies. Over time, the economy should improve. And in the short to medium term, this thing remains solid. So my view is that investors shouldn't be shook by this. They should be encouraged.
Let's continue the philosophical debate. Many developed economies, you'll agree, have significantly higher tax burdens than South Africa. I'm interested to know why the DA assumes that a tax increase would cripple growth rather than stabilize public finances.
I think the premise of that statement is perhaps a bit misdirected. When we talk about developing economies, often they are not able to collect revenue in any other way from their populace than through value-added tax. So personal income tax, estate tax, customs duties, all of these things don't apply as much to, you know, a separate developing nation as it does to South Africa. So we've got a diversified way of collecting revenue, and bluntly using VAT as an instrument to collect is one, anti-poor, and two, the SARS commissioner is telling us it's not going to be effective. He doesn't think it'll add the $60 billion to the fiscus that the ANC is saying that it will add. So we must compare like for like, and in places elsewhere in the world where they've got a diversified tax mix, they don't use VAT bluntly.
Dr. Mark Burke, thank you very much indeed. The Democratic Alliance spokesperson on finance.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa finding itself really in uncharted territory. For the first time in the democratic era, a national budget speech has been delayed. The Speaker of Parliament making the announcement, citing a cabinet deadlock. Opposition leaders are calling this a sign of a government in crisis. You'll know the ANC no longer has numbers to pass the budget alone, and negotiations with potential coalition partners appear to be at an impasse. So here's my question. What does this mean for South Africa's economy, governance, and international credibility? Political commentator TK Pueg, welcome. As I've said, an unprecedented situation. What does the delay tell us about the state of the GNU right now?
Well, it tells us that, look, things are not running as they were purported to be, and I think that's quite the problematic issue. Because it's not an issue that, look, after the SONA, then they start discussing the budget. This goes back all the way to the midterm, where they've got enough of a runway to start discussing it. The fact that they could not present the budget does kind of tell us that things are not really working in order. And I think that probably is more of the crisis. Legislatively, they will argue in terms of the PMFMA Section 27 that they have until June. But as you've correctly stated, historically, this has never happened. And the fact that they didn't even give forewarning kind of tells the markets that, listen, maybe these guys are not really understanding how serious a crisis of this country is and are not talking in that language of crisis.
We had the first indications, didn't we, when the DA came out very strongly saying it would support no tax hikes at all. But it's the forewarning that is of concern. All of this was very last minute, wasn't it?
And that's the nature of the problem that I think many South African citizens in the markets will not understand. You literally, from June, when the midterm, and October, when the midterm budget is given by the minister, the president, the minister of finance, and all other parties would have got together to say, listen, we have February 2025 to present this. what is our story going to be? So the fact that they've not been able to do this really just says that it does beg the question, if you need to ask, what have they been doing that they've had to wait, not in the last minute, basically it went through, we were told everything was going through, money was spent to have this event for today, and nothing.
Julius Malema says government has collapsed. Fikile Mbalula from the African National Congress says the delay is necessary to address fundamental questions. That in itself is quite vague. Which of these assessments is closer to the truth?
In between those two, I think that is the truth. Neither, I think, is correct. There's no truth in both, but there is a middle ground. And the middle ground, I'm sure this is what they are going to spin for the next coming few days, that by law, by the PMFMA Section 27, they have up until June. But I think those that are a bit more discerning are going to be worried that, listen, how is it that you literally had to wait till the last minute? It's not an issue of you can't walk this back. It's an issue of saying you now need to almost take the country and the markets into the confidence and say, this is why this is a problem and this is the debate. And I think people will be more understanding, as opposed to either being like the Secretary General of the ANC and say, listen, this is something small, we can manage it, or the opposite end, being in the red berets and saying the sky is falling. Yes, it is raining in Gauteng, but I don't think to that level.
So the ANC needs around 40 extra votes in Parliament to get this budget through when it is delivered. Is a compromise doable, do you think, or will there be a massive vote hunt from the ANC?
I think it will be a vote hunt, but I think that's the wrong way to go about doing. We do know there is a bit of a deficit, as Saz has explained to us, but I think to go look for it on the back of a hike, and also to look at it in the back of what the global environment looks like for South Africa going forward, is the wrong way to do it. The issue should be, and this is where I think the ANC for the first time is having to really understand this, that budget cut cannot come from already punishing citizens who are already stretched with their budgets. It needs to come from internally in the government, which is to say, what are you guys willing to compromise politically in terms of the issues of how we run our provinces and our municipalities, the number of bodyguards and everything that you have? That's where the cuts should really be coming from. You can't keep asking citizens who are already stretched, as indicators show us, that, listen, we're going to come to you in order to fill out the shortfall.
Do you think that the ANC failed to price in the risk of a potential increase in VAT? Did they just get this wrong?
Yeah, I think they missed the mark there. But I think it also goes back to the state of the nation, which is the president did promise many things there. And the question, and there's always been something which people have asked of previous SONAs, especially over the last 15 years, which is to say, when you make this SONA, why aren't you working with it with a real-time budget? Because you can't simply just go up on stage, promise many things, and then say, Minister of Finance, put that in for me. This should have really been a team together, the president with Treasury saying, I want to do this. What can I do? And I think that's always been the failing of the ANC over the last 15 years, especially.
So where does this leave President Ramaphosa? His flank is weak.
No, exceptionally. But I think the one thing he probably will do, and this is where I think maybe they have got a bit of a runway, is the issue that, look, the DA has not stepped out. What the DA simply said is, you need to come to the table as a humble party, and we need to discuss this. And I think that's probably the grace that's going to save the president, the fact that the DA has not walked out fully. And if you listen to what the other members of this coalition were saying in Parliament, none of them are willing to walk away. It's an issue of saying, how do we talk the language of compromise? But again, it has to be compromised based on what government can cut, because it cannot come out to the citizens.
How do you find that compromise, though?
Look, in the extreme end, and I think this is where we should be going, my argument, I think with you, we've always had this discussion, that I still don't see why we've got 278 municipalities. Why do we have these 9 provinces? A lot of what we have is provincial structures really should not exist. And I think that's where we should be finding money. We should be saying, how do we chop down government so that it's a bit more efficient? Not necessarily individuals, but structures which have been hanging around for the longest time, but they don't give us the type of economic development that we need. But I doubt that's the conversation they're going to have. What they're simply going to say is, you always go for the soft target, which is the social spending. And sometimes I agree to that, but I don't think in this situation time, because the issue is not this year. The issue should be, how do we really get a house in order for the coming 7 years? And my fear is that this coalition has not really discussed the language of 7 years. It's always a month-to-month crisis.
I don't like dealing in the realm of speculation, but let me put this question to you. We've got March 12 as the next budget. Let's assume it is delivered, but they again find difficulty in passing it. Could we be staring down the barrel of a constitutional crisis here?
Not necessarily. I think they have until June, so by law, and I think that's what probably gives some of them some comfort. The Minister of Finance was speaking about that language of, look, by law, they need to just wait for the new financial year, and it only starts before or around June. So they have got that runway. But how they explain this to the market is probably where the crisis, and I think that's where you're intimating, is going to become a bit of a problem. Because if it looks like they cannot find their way into June, then I think we should worry that we've got a constitutional crisis. And also, I don't think probably picking the month of March is the best thing. I think, isn't it the Ides of March? Bad things tend to happen in March. And I really think what they really should do, even if it means you push it to April, and I know that markets won't be happy, should be a discussion of, listen, let's truly ventilate this, and let's truly even get the private sector involved and have a discussion, say, these are our shortfalls, this is not what we're going to make. But I don't quite foresee that vision coming through.
What is the immediate impact on the workings of government, given that no budget has been delivered?
At this moment, they've got enough money, as far as I know, to go into probably the next 2 or 3 months. So that part is well. So the programs can still run. The issue will come in now when the unions start negotiating for the price increase. How do they do that if we don't know what the budget looks like? So you probably have to delay that. And then there's the issue of much larger issue of saying, listen, if we can't really do this by June, what happens? So I think they've got enough runway. By law, I think it's done. But it's, the damage, as you said, it's more the issue that people were not foretold and the markets were not foretold. And how you resolve that, I don't quite know.
This is going to take exemplary, tactful and very judicious leadership, isn't it?
Yes, and most important, it's going to take something which we've not had for the last 15 years, which is going to be taking firm decisions, which is to say you're willing to upset everyone in order to get to this decision. And what we know about our political elites, unfortunately, over the last 15 years, it's not they've been great at promising, but not necessarily making tough decisions. And hopefully this is not now the time that they start expressing this, because we also have to remember we have got a person in the United States who's not going to make life a bit easier for South Africans. So we really do need to get our house in order.
Well, let's see how this plays out in the next couple of days. From the Wits School of Governance, commentator TK Puer, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the budget drama yesterday, the delay all hinging over a dispute around raising value-added tax. And I want to focus on that now. South Africa's economic woes are no secret, rising debt, sluggish growth and an ever-tightening fiscal squeeze. And the government reportedly was considering hiking VAT to 17%, all as a way to plug the budget deficit. Now, supporters were arguing it's the most efficient way to raise revenue quickly without overburdening the already stretched tax base. Critics, though, warning it could hit the poorest hardest and slow down economic activity. So let's get into the weeds of this debate. Professor André Roux is with us, economist at the Stellenbosch Business School. André, always a pleasure to talk to you. VAT increase to 17%, would it have made economic sense?
Jeremy, you know, it's one of those things in economics, always trade-offs, and you can argue both in favor of and against something very convincingly. But I think perhaps a bit of a context here. If you have a look at the script of at least the first half of the budget speech, it was all very fine, very good, very understandable, very orthodox, talking about the desperate need to reduce or slow down the growth in government debt. No one can deny that. The need to grow the economy, obviously, via infrastructure spending, yes, no problem with that. Some fairly realistic forecasts for growth, you know, not all that ambitious, but nonetheless realistic. So halfway through, plain sailing. And then suddenly comes the notion of revenue and tax proposals. And he makes a point, which also is very valid, in saying that, you know, this is all very difficult, the balancing act. There are three options. Either cut spending, or take on more debt, which we don't want to happen, or make strategic tax adjustments. His next sentence reads, after careful analysis of the trade-offs, we have chosen the most responsible path forward. Now, one would have hoped you then have said, namely, to cut unnecessary government spending. But he didn't say that. The next sentence reads, to raise the VAT rate by 2 percentage points. But it gets even worse. A necessary step that will enable us to fund public sector wage increases for civil servants. So, you know, the whole way in which this was composed was even marginally offensive. So it's actually saying, everyone out there, you're going to pay more tax, primarily to finance civil servant wage increases. And this is where the crux of the story lies. One would rather have seen no fiddling around the taxes, or no major fiddling around. I mean, we always get an increase in sin taxes. That's kind of part of the course. but rather focusing on the cutting back on government spending. Admittedly, there aren't all that many avenues. Politically, we can hardly see them cutting back on civil servant salaries. Social grants, they seem to be part and parcel of the system. We can't cut back on those. We don't want to cut back on health and education, but there must be other areas. They're not necessarily cutting back, but saving on unfruitful and unauthorized and wasteful spending. Surely there's money to be saved there. The commissioner, Mr. Kiesewetter, pointed out a couple of days ago that he would not welcome any increase in taxes, and went on to say that there could be hundreds of billions of rand that are not being collected because of various log jams in the system. If we can get rid of those log jams, we collect without organically a few hundred billion rand. And that would plug the gap.
Do you think
this is a question of timing and context?
Do you think this was politically ill thought through, given that VAT is seen as a regressive tax hitting lower income households the hardest?
Well, yes. I mean, he does quite rightly point out further on, and everyone would agree with this, but you know, to consider raising personal income tax would not be smart at this stage. As it is, we all know personal income taxpayers are overburdened. To raise corporate tax rates wouldn't be very clever either, because we want to attract more investment that would deter investment. So it's kind of a process of elimination. But having said that, yes, you're quite right. It's always deemed to be perceived to be a regressive tax, hurting the poor more than not so poor. He does say in the original budget speech, don't worry about that, because we will protect vulnerable households by expanding the list of VAT zero-rated items, such as tinned vegetables and dairy liquid blends and various meat products. He also, in the original speech, the one that wasn't read, spoke about more fuel levy relief, not raising that, and then increasing social grant increases by more than inflation, and adjusting income tax brackets to kind of shield us against fiscal drag, both for the poor and the not so poor. So in their way of thinking, there was some kind of quid pro quo for raising the VAT rate. But nonetheless, as you could argue both ways, although VAT is deemed to be the fairest kind of tax, because everyone pays, in our context, it often turns out to be less than fair. So no, to answer your question, I don't think it was as well thought out as it should be.
And Professor, had this announcement gone through, what would a higher VAT rate have done in terms of inflation?
Well, I mean, if you bear in mind that a big chunk of the goods in the inflation basket and services are subject to VAT, it naturally would have raised the inflation, not by 2%, but by some margin, perhaps 0.5%. I've done the calculation. It would inevitably have raised the inflation rate. And I suppose he might have argued, okay, but you know what, the inflation is nice and low at the moment, so another few percentage points won't make a major difference. But those are hollow words if you address them to the very poor, who, as it is, are suffering, as we all know, from a really profound cost of living crisis.
And there's a vicious circle here as well. Given our current weak economic growth, a hike might have further suppressed consumer demand, and that in itself would have led to lower than expected revenue gains in the long run.
Absolutely. It's a vicious circle. I mean, if the economy is growing at, well, maybe if we're lucky, 1.5% this year, and even less in the last few years, that means the tax base is growing at a very sluggish speed. And that's part of the problem. You cannot rely upon an expanding tax base to generate organically more revenue. If the economy is growing at 3 or 4%, well, then many other problems would be solved or partially solved, not least of which, as I just said, organic growth in tax revenue without fiddling around the tax rates. But also, these pesky debt level ratios. So it's government debt divided by GDP. So the number below the line, GDP, is growing by 3 or 4% in real terms, which means nominally by 10%. Then you can raise government debt as long as it's less than 10%, and the ratio gets smaller. So the need for growth is both immediate and, of course, long-term and structural.
Always appreciate the analysis. Economist at the Stellenbosch Business School, Professor André Roux, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at Midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, travel is evolving beyond traditional long-haul holidays. As this year unfolds, I'm reading that more and more people are opting for shorter, more frequent getaways that prioritize affordability, sustainability, and meaningful experiences. So the modern traveler is really redefining the way in which they explore the world. So I want to get into the economics of this and find out exactly what people are doing and where they're going. Lara Dendy-Young is with us, Chief Executive Officer, co-founder of the travel company Conservio. Lara, welcome. So why are we opting for shorter, more frequent getaways? Is it all about the wallet?
Jeremy, I think it's about a few things. The one thing is that travel's become a lot more accessible, and I think especially locally, and also let's speak in the context of South Africa, there's so much available on our doorstep that people are able to travel more frequently. So I think it's got a little bit to do with that. It's got a little bit because we are able to access these different types of travels in close proximity to where we stay, it has also made it more affordable. There's no longer that need for that June, July holiday, long-haul trip, get out of South Africa so we can go have summer somewhere else. Travel in itself has actually just become more affordable, more accessible, and closer. So I think that's why we're seeing this uptick in travel and the frequency of it.
And you also make the point that people are prioritizing experience over luxury. I'm not 100% sure whether I'm part of that cohort, but then I'm probably a bit older. But why is that?
Well, do you know what? I think the definition of luxury has changed. So maybe it's not so much like I think what we are seeing is that whole white glove service is no longer. I think that defining luxury, I think luxury is now defined by space, about having something that feels like yours, about experiencing something unique. So it's not so much that what am I getting in terms of like the luxuries we used to know it, but it's more about like, am I experiencing something that is harder to access for most people? So I think that's why we see these like isolated locations like away from the city being a form of luxury. I think space and time to just reset and relax is becoming a luxury for so many. I think this like life as we know it and this treadmill and this feeling of busyness is making luxury look a lot different for a lot of like consumers out there.
But having said that, Lara, please tell me you're not taking away my room service and spa treatment.
No, you can still have all of that. Sure. There's a lot of that. And the best thing about that is you can still have that and have the isolation. Because I think that's the difference as well, that used to be something that you couldn't have, you know, like in an isolated area, whereas now that is very much, that's the status quo.
Lara, please explain to me what a mini moon is.
A mini moon. Oh, there's so many moons. You've got baby moons, mini moons, honeymoons, all of it. The mini moon is the little honeymoon that you do. You don't do the big honeymoon after the wedding. It's the short little weekend away, long weekend away, post wedding, and then you plan for the honeymoon. All of these terms are also quite new to me, but yeah, it's amazing how many how many reasons there are to do weekends away now. It's quite amazing.
Are you telling me, because I have an elder daughter that has just got engaged and at some point I'm going to have to make contributions here, I might have to contribute to a mini moon and maybe even a honeymoon? You're kidding me. This is all your fault, Lara.
You're going to have two on your card. Well, at least you know where to book them.
Tell me why it's so important for travelers to now incorporate sustainability into a travel choice. I mean, this is a trend that really is starting to accelerate.
Yeah, and I think it's because, I mean, there's a couple of reasons as well. And I think travel in itself has also, you know, it hasn't been in the best light. I mean, there's a lot of flight shame and there's a lot of thought about why you travel. And I think a lot of people think that if I'm going to travel, like if I'm going to, you know, fly somewhere or drive somewhere or do that, there needs to be meaning behind it. And I think that's what we're also seeing, is that there is this desire because we want to do something, but we want to do it well. And I think that's a trend across consumers in general. I mean, we're seeing that your wallet and the way you spend your money can make a difference. And I think people are really taking on that responsibility. I think especially with travel and especially with nature-based travel, is that there is a feeling that you want to feel good when you're there. You want to experience nature and feel good when you're there. And you don't want to feel like you haven't done something that's not in keeping with the environment that you're experiencing. So I think that is why that kind of trend is definitely increasing, all that consumer behavior.
Do you think the travel industry in South Africa is keeping up with that demand for more eco-friendly accommodation?
I think actually South Africa has, like, especially in terms of, like, I mean, if we think of the safari industry, they have really been like pioneers of this. Like, conservation-based tourism has been, like, we do it so well in this country. And I think what we definitely see, and so my short answer is absolutely yes. We have these most amazing natural landscapes, like, across South Africa, across our neighboring countries as well. And I think that is definitely celebrated in the type of travel that we offer. So, I mean, we see it in abundance. Like, that is the one thing that I constantly find astounding, is how many properties we can find that are exactly the type of properties we want to list. These places that celebrate, that protect, that, like, give beautiful access to nature, that offer something that's impactful. It's in abundance, and there's demand, there's enough supply. It's a really, really amazing space.
And just a final one before I let you go. Interesting to see that last-minute getaways are becoming more popular. There is an advantage to booking on short notice, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, first of all, if there's availability, there's often – these places want to fill their beds. So there are offers, there are deals. There's a lot of, they really want to encourage, especially the local markets, to travel at last minute. And again, I think that's the beauty of traveling locally, is that there is so much. So if you do leave something last minute, you're going to be able to find something that you're looking for. So I think I think that's amazing for the local markets, to know that it doesn't all get booked up in advance. You can find it, you can book it on an amazing deal, and you can really, like, get those places in your calendar.
So Lara Dendy-Young, I'm hearing room service knocking at my door, so I'm going to end the interview. Thank you very much for talking to us. Chief Executive Officer, co-founder of the travel company Conservia. And that is our program for today. We are back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.